Well, welcome to the study for February 8th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 2100 hours exactly, so I thought I'd better start when I noticed the time being an exact hour. Eastern Standard Time, 2100 hours. Our study for today, little children. I've watched all the videos recently on JW.org, the ones that just came out. Really enjoyed the talk by Brother Hyatt, and the JW broadcasting was interesting, but I'll have more to say about it later, I think. In today's study of the Crucible, the C-Cubed article, Crucible of Credible Creed, we have paragraph 7 of the Arabian Tradition, which is an inset in chapter 6 of that article, Crucible of Credible Creed. The problem is solved, that is the problem of the baby Moses not having anyone to feed him after he was put among the reeds. And the story is found, this particular part of the story, in Exodus chapter 2, and in particular verse 8, when the mother of Moses is obtained to be his wet nurse, and she becomes then a foster parent, because there was the danger of the baby starving after they found him in the reeds, or in the Arabian tradition, they found him, and there may well have been reeds there, but it was called the bathing tank in the palace of Pharaoh, which may well have had reeds in it as well. It's not quite known. But further details are related in the book called The Beer of the Bible by former Cairo brewer Mr. James Death on page 127. How well the Arabian version agrees with the Bible itself. The additional details in the Arab tradition merely expand upon the Bible and appeal to our emotional sensitivities. That's the end of our study in the Crucible article for today. They certainly give us intimate details that were not contained in the Bible about the events surrounding the baby Moses having been put in the ark of papyrus reeds and placed in the Nile River. So, for today, little children, we've got our study from our scripture from Proverbs 20 and 6. A multitude of men will proclaim each one his own loving kindness, but a faithful man who can find? And isn't that remarkable? It's another principle from God's Word, and there are many, many principles that are principles of truth in life. And one could argue that they're all contained in the Bible, but that's not necessary to contend that, perhaps, but it's possible that one could contend that every single truth is in the Bible. And a multitude of men, this is one principle. The idea that everybody's out there claiming that they have the truth, or that they're the one who's got the real love, or that they're the one who is the best, or whatever it is they're claiming, some kind of loving kindness that they're proclaiming about themselves as coming from them, as though they are the source, you see? This is the idea. In other words, people who claim to be the true anything, the true God's representatives, or the true, you know, like the idea of the faithful and discreet slave of the Bible. There could be people who are claiming to be that faithful slave as an organization, and they're proclaiming their own idea about what this loving kindness is, you see. And the real issue is, who is faithful and who is humble, more importantly? Humble enough to say, well, I don't know. And God knows, and God's the only one who knows. That takes humility. And I think that's the way I was brought up. That we didn't know much. We knew that we didn't know much, and we knew that the only one who knew was God. And even the church we knew didn't know. We knew all that because we were raised that way. But it's troubling to me. It's one thing that troubles me is when people think that they are the source of knowledge, then they pursue. I'll have to talk about this later because we won't have time today. But they pursue, for example, the publishing of the good news, trying to translate the good news into every language on earth. That's one approach, right? And the question may come up, is that the right approach? Or is there a better approach to conveying the good news? One way might be to teach everybody on earth the English language, for example. If everybody knew the same language, wouldn't that make it easier? I mean, English just happens to be one language that is already known to be a good language for diversity of expression and for widespread use. But, I mean, it could be another language that's used instead of English, but English is one that comes to mind. Why can't we somehow get an education system that teaches everyone English? But, I mean, it's just a thought that comes to my mind. How much easier would that be if everybody spoke the same language, no matter what the language were? Then the king sent, 2 Kings 23, and to gather together to him all the older men of Judah and of Jerusalem. This is King Josiah. After that, the king went up to the house of Jehovah, and also all the men of Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem with him, and also the priests and the prophets and all the people from small to great. And he began to read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant that had been found in the house of Jehovah. And the king kept standing by the pillar and now concluded the covenant before Jehovah to walk after Jehovah and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and with all the soul. With all the heart and with all the soul, by carrying out the words of this covenant that were written in this book. Accordingly, all the people took their stand in the covenant. And the king went on to command Hilkiah the high priest and the priests of the second rank and the doorkeepers to bring out from the temple of Jehovah all the utensils made for Baal and for the sacred pole and for all the army of the heavens. Then he burned them outside Jerusalem on the terraces of Kidron, and he brought the dust of them to Bethel. And he put out of business the foreign god priests whom the kings of Judah had put in, that they might make sacrificial smoke on the high places in the cities of Judah and the surroundings of Jerusalem, and also those making sacrificial smoke to Baal, to the sun and to the moon and to the constellations of the zodiac and to all the army of the heavens. That's right, we don't worship the heavens as God's people. Jehovah's people, apparently, according to the Bible here, they didn't worship the heavens. Not like these other, what were they called here? Well, the worshippers of Baal, for example. Furthermore, he brought out the sacred pole from the house of Jehovah to the outskirts of Jerusalem. So he burned these things that were utensils made for Baal. Verse 4. Further, he brought out the sacred pole from the house of Jehovah to the outskirts of Jerusalem, to the torrent valley of Kidron, and burned it in the torrent valley of Kidron, and ground it to dust, and cast its dust upon the burial place of the sons of the people. Further, he pulled down the houses of the male temple prostitutes that were in the house of Jehovah, where the women were weaving tent shrines for the sacred pole. There are a lot of things involved with false worship described, are there not here, little children? Then he brought, verse 8, all the priests from the cities of Judah, that he might make unfit for worship the high places where the priests had made sacrificial smoke, from Geba as far as Beersheba. And he pulled down the high places of the gates that were at the entrance of the gate of Joshua, the chief of the city. The gate of Joshua, the chief of the city. What's that? That's interesting. Joshua was the chief of the city of Jerusalem. Is he talking about Jerusalem there? It's not quite clear. which was at the left as a person came into the gate of the city. Only the priests of the high places would not come up to the altar of Jehovah in Jerusalem. It sounds like he's talking about Jerusalem. But they ate unfermented cakes in among their brothers, and he made unfit for worship Topheth, which is in the valley of the sons of Hinnom, that, you know, Jesus referred to Gehenna, which is related to this valley of the sons of Hinnom, that no one might make his son or his daughter, because he made it unfit for worship, pass through the fire to Molech. No one might make his son or daughter pass through the fire to Molech. Further, he caused the horses that the kings of Judah had given to the sun to cease from entering the house of Jehovah by the dining room of Nathan Melech, the court official, which was in the porticos, and the chariots of the sun he burned in the fire, and the altars that were upon the roof of the roof chamber of Ahaz, that the kings of Judah had made these altars, and the altars that Manasseh had made in two courtyards of the house of Jehovah, the king pulled down, after which he crushed them there, and he cast their dust into the torrent valley of Kidron. This torrent valley of Kidron was also outside Jerusalem, right? But this Topheth in the valley of the sons of Hinnom, that was where they threw their sons and daughters. Were passed their sons and daughters through the fire to this false god Molech. Disgraceful thing that they did. And the high places that were in front of Jerusalem, that were to the right of the Mount of Ruination that Solomon, the king of Israel, had built to Ashtoreth, the disgusting thing of the Sidonians, and to Chemosh, the disgusting thing of Moab, and to Milcom, the detestable thing of the sons of Ammon, the king made unfit for worship. They were in front of Jerusalem. So he is talking about Jerusalem. When he mentioned that the chief of the city was Joshua, and there was a gate called the Gate of Joshua in verse 8, which was at the left as a person came into the gate of the city. And right. Oh, yes, okay. And so let's read from verse 13 again. And the high places that were in front of Jerusalem that were to the right of the Mount of Ruination that Solomon, the king of Israel, had built to Ashtoreth. See, Solomon was not a good king in his latter years. He built this high place to Ashtoreth, or more than one high place. Ashtoreth is also the word from which we have the word Easter. So Easter is not a good celebration because it's related to this goddess Ashtoreth, the disgusting thing of the Sidonians. She's called the disgusting thing of the Sidonians, a bad false god to worship that they worshipped in Solomon's time also. And to Chemosh, the disgusting thing of Moab, and Milcom, the detestable thing of the sons of Ammon, the king made unfit for worship these high places. And he broke the sacred pillars to pieces and went on to cut down the sacred poles and to fill their places with human bones. So we'll see why he did that in what follows. And also the altar that was in Bethel, the high place that Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin, had made. The altar that was in Bethel, the high place that Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the first rebel who was the one who instigated the divided kingdom, had built. Even that altar on the high place he pulled down. Then he burned the high place, he ground it to dust, and burned the sacred pole. When Josiah turned, he got to see the burial places that were there in the mountain. So he sent and took the bones from the burial places and burned them upon the altar, that he might make it unfit for worship, according to Jehovah's word that the man of the true God had proclaimed. If you recall that, O altar, this is what Jehovah has said. Look, a son born to the house of David. 1 Kings 13 and 2. Whose name is Josiah, and he will certainly sacrifice upon you the priests of the high places that are making sacrificial smoke upon you, and men's bones he will burn upon you. We'll see about the priests in a moment, but the bones he burned here upon these altars. He burned them upon the altar. Verse 16, that he might make it unfit for worship. According to Jehovah's word, that the man of the true God, at the man of the true God whom we just read about in 1 Kings 13 and 2 had proclaimed, who proclaimed these things, then he said, what is the gravestone over there that I'm seeing? At this, the men of the city said to him, it is the burial place of the man of the true God that came from Judah and proceeded to proclaim these things that you have done against the altar of Bethel. The very prophet himself, it was his burial place. So he said, let him rest. Do not let anyone disturb his bones. Consequently, they let his bones alone, along with the bones of the prophet that had come from Samaria. Evidently, he was the other prophet who had encountered this first prophet. And the story of that we've gone through already in our previous readings, in 2 Kings 13 and 2, for example. And that chapter 13, it talks about those things. And also all the houses of the high places that were in the cities of Samaria that the kings of Israel had built to cause offense, Josiah removed. And he went on to do to them according to all the doings that he had done at Bethel. All the houses of the high places that were in the cities of Samaria, verse 19, he did that same thing to all of those high places and those houses of high places. Accordingly, he sacrificed all the priests of the high places, it says there. This is almost said as a passing comment. Accordingly, he sacrificed all the priests of the high places that were there upon the altars and burned human bones upon them. After that, he returned to Jerusalem. He sacrificed all the priests. That means he killed them all by sacrificing them upon the altars of the high places. It sounds like that's what it says. And burned human bones upon them. So it's said as almost a passing thought. But that would be also the fulfillment of what that prophet had spoken at 1 Kings 13 and 2. He will sacrifice upon you altar, the altar, upon this altar that he called altar, he would sacrifice upon that altar the priests of the high places. That was the prophecy. And it came true. The king now commanded all the people, saying, hold a Passover to Jehovah your God. Oh, this is the chronological information. Hold a Passover to Jehovah your God according to what is written in this book of the covenant. This is what Josiah commanded. For no Passover like this, it goes on to say, this is not what he commanded, but it says, for no Passover like this had been held from the days of the judges that had judged Israel, nor all the days of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah. But in the 18th year of King Josiah, this Passover was held to Jehovah in Jerusalem. And we know from Jewish tradition, this is said to be the Jubilee year, which is the 16th Jubilee, and it would have been, according to our chronology, which we think is very true, partly because of this, but it's very, very true that in our chronology, this 18th year is close to, if not the exact year of 622 BCE. It looks like it's the exact year 622 BCE, which would be the Passover year known as the 16th Passover. And also the mediums, the spirit mediums and the professional foretellers of events, verse 24, and the teraphim and the dungy idols and all the disgusting things that had appeared in the land of Judah and in Jerusalem, Josiah cleared out in order that he might actually carry out the words of the law that were written in the book that Hilkiah the priest had found at the house of Jehovah. And like him, that is Josiah, there did not prove to be a king prior to him who returned to Jehovah with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his vital force, according to all the law of Moses. Neither after him has there risen up one like him. Nevertheless, Jehovah did not turn back from the great burning of his anger, with which his anger burned against Judah over all the offensive things with which Manasseh had made them offend. Right. For example, Manasseh was one of the worst kings of all of the kings of Judah. But Jehovah said, Judah too I shall remove from my sight, just as I have removed Israel. And I shall certainly reject this city that I have chosen, even Jerusalem. We know that Nebuchadnezzar did conquer Jerusalem in the year BCE 587, because we know, and also the year 604 as year one of Nebuchadnezzar is one of the most certain dates in all of ancient history, you know, from any time before, let's say, or after 700 BCE. Year one of Nebuchadnezzar, 604 BCE, is very well known. But Jehovah was going to reject Jerusalem, and it would be by means of Nebuchadnezzar, of course, that he would do that. And the house of which I have said my name will continue there. He also burnt the house, Nebuchadnezzar did. He burnt Jehovah's house. And that was the house about which Jehovah said my name will continue there. In verse 28 now, as for the rest of the affairs of Josiah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the affairs of the days of the kings of Judah? In his days, Pharaoh Necho, the king of Egypt, came up to the king of Assyria by the river Euphrates. And this is more chronological information. We know when Pharaoh Necho ruled from the Egyptian chronology. And King Josiah proceeded to go and meet him, and he put him to death at Megiddo. That is, Necho put Josiah to death as soon as he saw him. So his servants conveyed him dead in a chariot from Megiddo, that is, Josiah's dead body, and brought him to Jerusalem and buried him in his grave. Then the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and anointed him and made him king in place of his father. 23 years old was Jehoahaz when he began to reign. And Josiah was killed in the year BCE 609, according to Daniel Kahn, who also, according to whom also year 1 of Sargon is 722, I believe he says, or 720, either that or 721. He's got a very similar chronology to ours for these dates, or we've adopted his dates, depending on how you look at it. 23 years old was Jehoahaz when he began to reign, and for 3 months he reigned in Jerusalem. But we've included in our chronology all the Bible and all of the surrounding facts of history and archaeology and everything. And his mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah from Libna, and astronomy we've included too. And he began to do what was bad in Jehovah's eyes according to all that forefathers of his had done. See, Genesis chapter 1, verse 14 talks about the heavens, the luminaries in the heavens were for signs and for seasons. We were to use them, not to worship them, but to use them. And that's why we used astronomy in the genealogy to find the correct chronology. And Pharaoh, and we hope it's correct. We believe it's correct. And we keep adjusting it when we learn more if we are wrong. But Pharaoh Necho got to put Jehoahaz in bonds at Riblah in the land of Hamath to keep him from reigning in Jerusalem, and then imposed a fine upon the land of 100 silver talents and a gold talent. Furthermore, Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, the other son of Josiah, and another son, in place of Josiah, his father, he made him king, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. And Jehoahaz he took and then brought to Egypt, where he eventually died. And the silver and the gold Jehoiakim gave to Pharaoh, only he taxed the land to give the silver at the order of Pharaoh. According to each one's individual tax rate, he exacted the silver and the gold from the people of the land to give it to Pharaoh Necho. So he's well-known, Pharaoh Necho. What's the chronology of... I want to look up Semeticus the first. I think... I think his year one is 664. That's what my memory's telling me. Yeah, so that's very well known in Egyptian history, 664. And in our chronology, it's the same thing. 664 BCE is year one of Semeticus, Egyptian history. It's well-determined, and it's almost day-exact history where they know to the very day. It's considered by some people to be day-exact, even from the first year of Taharqa, who began to rule about 692 or 691 BCE, which is not day-exact exactly in our chronology, but according to some people it is. But Semeticus the first, 664, and then Necho 610 was his year one. Necho the first. Sorry, it's Necho the second. Necho the second is the successor of Semeticus. He's the one talked about here, Necho the second. 25 years old was Jehoiakim when he began to reign. And for 11 years he reigned in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Zebidah, the daughter of Pedaiah from Ruma. And he continued to do what was bad in Jehovah's eyes, did Jehoiakim, according to all that his forefathers, or that forefathers of his, had done. And that's all for our reading of 2 Kings 23. That was a ton of information, was it not? And it explains a lot of things which we can briefly show here, too, in some form by looking at our table H4 in the Moses article. Part 2 of the Moses article, Josiah's 31 years of rule from 639 to 608, so his year 18 is 622, which is a jubilee year in our chronology. Jehoahaz for 3 months in 608. Jehoiakim from 608 to 597, 11 years until the first exile. The exile by Nebuchadnezzar in his year 7 prior to the destruction of the temple in 587. In year 18 of Nebuchadnezzar. But Jehoiakim, 608 to 597, those are they not 11 years? We do the math? Right, okay, we're done for that. Now we're ready to look at Ezekiel and see how much time we have left. Oh my goodness, we're running out of time already. And gradually he brought me back to the entrance of the house. We did a lot of reading though. And look, there was water going forth, Ezekiel writes, from under the threshold of the house eastward, for the front of the house was east, and the water was going down from under, from the right hand side of the house, south of the altar. And he gradually brought me forth by the way of the north gate, and took me around by the way outside to the outer gate that is facing toward the east. And look, water was trickling from the right hand side. When the man went forth eastward with a measuring line in his hand, he also proceeded to measure 1,000 in cubits, 1,000 in cubits, and to make me pass through the water up to the ankles. And he continued measuring 1,000, and then made me pass through the water up to the knees. And he continued measuring 1,000, and now made me pass through water up to the hips. And he continued measuring 1,000. It was a torrent that I was not able to pass through, for the water had got high, water permitting swimming, a torrent that could not be passed through. At that he said to me, "Have you seen this, O son of man?" Then he had me walk and had me return to the bank of the torrent. When I returned, why look, on the bank of the torrent, there were very many trees on this side and on that side. This is really fascinating, I find. Let me see if I can get some more brightness on our monitor here. I think that's a little brighter. Yeah. And he went on to say to me, "This water is going forth to the eastern region," verse 8 of Ezekiel 47, "and must go down through the Arabah," which is the Salt Sea... river valley, or it's, yeah, that's right, "and it must come to the sea. It being brought forth into the sea itself, its water is also actually healed. And it must occur that every living soul that swarms in every place to which the double-sized torrent comes will get life. And it must occur that there will be very many fish, because there is where this water will certainly come. And the seawater will be healed, and everything will be alive where the torrent comes. And it must occur that fishers will actually stand alongside it from En-Gedi even up to En-Eglaim. There will come to be a drying yard for dragnets. In their kinds, their fish will prove to be like the fish of the great sea, very many." That would be, sounds like the Mediterranean Sea they're talking about when they say the great sea. "There are its swampy places and its marshy places, and they will not be healed. To salt they will certainly be given." They will not be healed. Verse 11. "And alongside the torrent that will come up along its bank on this side and on that side, all sorts of trees for food. Their leafage will not wither, nor will their fruitage be consumed. In their months they will bear new fruit, because the water for them, it is coming forth from the very sanctuary." That's where the water was trickling under the threshold, on the east of the sanctuary, "and their fruitage must prove to be for food, and their leafage for healing." Little children, look at that thing. The fruitage is for food, and the leafage is for healing. This is what the Sovereign Lord Jehovah has said. This is the territory that you will assign to yourselves for inheritance as the land for the 12 tribes of Israel, with two pieces of field to Joseph. And you people must inherit it, each one the same as his brother, which land I raised my hand in an oath to give to your forefathers. That's the promised land. And this land must fall to you by lot for inheritance. And this is the boundary of the land to the northern side from the great sea, by the way of Hethlon as one comes to Zedad, Hamath, Berotha, Sibraim, which is between the boundary of Damascus and the boundary of Hamath, Hazer Hatikon, which is toward the boundary of Hauran, and the boundary from the sea must prove to be Hazer Enon, the boundary of Damascus and northward, and the boundary of Hamath. This is the northern side, and the eastern side is from between Hauran and Damascus and between Gilead and the land of Israel. The Jordan, from the boundary to the eastern sea, you people should measure. This is the eastern side. And the southern side is to the south from Tamar to the waters of Meribeth Kadesh, the Torrent Valley to the Great Sea. This is the side to the south toward the Negev, and the western side is the Great Sea from the boundary straight ahead to the entering into Hamath. This is the western side. Got 2 minutes. And you must apportion this land to yourselves, to the 12 tribes of Israel. And it must occur that you should allot it for inheritance to yourselves and to the alien residents who are residing as aliens in your midst, who have become father to sons in the midst of you. And they must become to you like a native among the sons of Israel. With you people, they will fall by lot into an inheritance in the midst of the tribes of Israel. And it must occur that in the tribe with which the alien resident has taken up residence as an alien, there is where you should give his inheritance, is the utterance of the Sovereign Lord Jehovah. That's the end of Ezekiel chapter 47. We have about 1 minute.
There's this thing.
Just because somebody wants to be free and have free will does not mean that they're a liar. There's a difference between freedom and lies, obviously. So, there were lies told, you know, the lie the devil told to Eve in the Garden of Eden. He told an outright lie. That's what, at least that's the interpretation that's being given, right? It's an interpretation. It doesn't say right there that it was a lie, but it says, but Jesus knew it was a lie. And we know that there are ways of ascertaining what the truth is. That's the main thing. But freedom is important. We mustn't forget that. Okay. And I'll talk more about that later, but for now, that's the end of our video. It's February 8th, 2024, of the Common Era, and the time is 21:33 hours Eastern Standard Time. I'm Ward Green, and I love you very much. It's been great to be with you. In my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, saying, let's see if I can get some light. I can't get a light shining on her. Oh, come on. Where's the light coming from? There. Saying bye for now.